This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us.
Guest today has been on Church and Culture before at least one time, probably more, but Steve Mosier is internationally known as president of the Population Research Institute. He's a great advocate and has been for 40 years for human rights in China. He was instrumental in first exposing China's one-child policy, for which he got thrown out of Stanford, but we've already talked about that on Church and Culture. Steve Mosier, thanks for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Dale.
Now, you've written a number of books about China, and you have a new one out called Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order from Regnery, beautifully bound. Great cover, by the way, very colorful and eye-catching. Steve, this book really scared me. It's been a long time since I've read a book that actually scared me, and scared me for our nation, for our culture, for my kids, their kids, your 9 kids. I had really no idea that China posed this level of threat until I read your book. And I guess the way I want to start off is to ask you, are we focusing on the wrong nation when we focus on North Korea?
Well, I think there's no question, Deal, that North Korea is a sideshow. And I know that the media, which has the attention span of a mayfly, spends a lot of attention on this impoverished one-party dictatorship, which is slowly starving its 25 million people to death while it builds a few missiles and nuclear weapons. But North Korea is not a global threat. It's really nothing. It's really little more than a regional threat. But the main point is to understand is that North Korea is China. That is to say, North Korea wouldn't even exist if it weren't for China. We all remember the Korean War when we were about to defeat the communists in Korea when the big brother, China, intervened, sending a million troops and human wave attacks down into the Korean Peninsula and driving us back to the 38th parallel. So Kim Jong-un's half-kingdom, his half-hermit kingdom, wouldn't even exist if it weren't for China. It wouldn't exist for very long, even today, if China closed the border with North Korea, because 90% of North Korea's trade goes across the border with China. It has a little border with Russia, about 10% of the trade goes there. If China were to close its border, stop importing North Korean coal, and stop exporting missile components and components for nuclear power plants and other advanced technology that North Korea needs to build its nukes and build its missiles, North Korea would cease to exist very quickly. The country would simply implode. South Korea, of course, could take it over, and the Korean Peninsula would be unified under a free market democracy, which would be good for the Korean people and good for the world. So when we focus on North Korea to the exclusion of China, we're basically falling for a Chinese strategic deception, which is basically, look at North Korea. North Korea is such a threat to America. You have to focus on North Korea. Ignore what we're doing in the East China Sea against Japan. Ignore our threats to take back Taiwan by force. Ignore our threats against the Philippines, Vietnam, and other countries around the South China Sea. Ignore our territorial claims in India. You need to focus on North Korea, and we can help you deal with the problem. Well, they've been helping us deal with the problem, so-called, at the same time they've been creating the problem for the last 25 years, and you see where that's gotten us today. So, we need to, every time you hear North Korea is a threat, remember that China is behind that threat. China created that threat, and China, when it wants to solve that threat, China has a mutual security treaty with North Korea guaranteeing to defend it from attack. That's the bottom line.
Well, let me share with our listeners why I was scared by your book, and I'm going to so strongly recommend to all of them to read it. I really think it's, you know, I hate to say must read because so many people say must read. And when they say must read to me, I go, oh, no, I don't want anybody telling me what to read. But yours, I would say, and I say this softly to my listeners, it's a must read. What you show through a thorough examination of the entire history of China is that China's, as you put it, in China's DNA is a will to hegemony, a will to be an entirely authoritarian country or nation. In other words, it's going to be a top-down dictatorship. And regardless of what we see, and you call it, I think, the silk dress, whether it's Confucianism or whether it's the false promises of communism, or whatever you see as a mask, behind that mask is the attitude that we are the most superior people, we have the most superior civilization and culture, and we are destined to rule the world. Now, do I exaggerate what I got from your book?
No, I mean, that's the thesis of Bully of Asia, and that is to say, going back to the beginning, you know, 2,200 years ago, that China long ago invented totalitarianism, which is, of course, the total subjugation of the individual to the state. And it still practices a modified form of that today. You know, it's an odd thing to think about. Americans are addicted to the idea of progress. Things get better all the time. But China, 2,200 years ago, came together as a country for the first time under a dictator, an emperor, who was an absolute despot, who had political commissars in the military, who had control of the production of iron and salt, that is, economic control of important commodities. He had organized the peasants into a kind of primitive commune system. He had song and dance troops going around the country singing his praises, that is, propaganda troops. He had official censorship. He burned the books of competing ideas, ideas that conflicted with his idea of how there can only be one emperor. And he actually killed Confucian scholars and other scholars who opposed him on that. So everything we associate with a modern-day tyranny, one-party dictatorship, communist dictatorship, we saw in China 2,200 years ago. So people need to understand that it wasn't Marx and Lenin who invented a one-party dictatorship. It was China itself over 2,000 years ago. And unfortunately today, what we see is China reverting to type, China going back to its founding in terms of how it's trying to organize society and how the government is organizing itself. What we have in Xi Jinping, the president of China, is a new red emperor. Now, we already had one red emperor. He was called Chairman Mao Zedong. And he had considerable power, but he was never as powerful, I would argue, as President Xi Jinping is today. Why? Because Xi Jinping controls the army. He's the chairman of the military commission. He controls the Chinese Communist Party. He controls the government as president. He also sits in charge of seven little committees he set up in charge of national security and the economy and other aspects. All the levers of power are in his hands. All roads lead to Xi Jinping. So he is a new red emperor. He's got a personality cult that is blossoming around the country. He is selling millions of copies of his collected works, his collected speeches, in the same way that Mao did, in the same way that Mao's Little Red Book was memorized by millions and millions of Red Guards who then went on rampages. So Xi Jinping's collected works and speeches, his sayings, are being memorized by millions of Chinese Communist Party members who are trying to impress their fellow comrades. So we have China going in the wrong direction. Now, if we imagine, if we had hoped 30 years ago that China was going to become just like us, that it was going to democratize, that economic freedom was going to lead to political freedom, all that has gone by the wayside. China is a lot more powerful today, a lot more wealthy today than it was 30 years ago. But it is even more despotic than it was 30 years ago. So things are moving in the wrong direction.
Well, Steve Mosier, talking about your new book, Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. Why didn't you call it Why China's Historic Preoccupation is the New Threat to World Order? Or the
well,
constant threat?
I thought Bully of Asia encapsulated what China...
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And, you know, one thing you point out is that to this day, students, young students in China are taught very anti-American attitudes. They're taught cultural racial superiority. They're taught to have very long memories of colonial days and the defeat on the two opium wars when Britain, led by the UK, well, I guess then it was just Great Britain, defeated the then, I forget which one of the dynasties it was. All of this is very much, like you say, it's being pressed into the DNA of the Chinese citizen.
Well, the Chinese people are rightly proud of many aspects of their own civilization. I don't want
And you make that clear in your book. You make that clear. We're just talking about political attitudes and what you call the hegemon.
Right. But what happened on June 4th, 1989 was pivotal. That was the day that the Tiananmen demonstrations, which saw millions of people in China's major cities demonstrating for freedom, for liberty, quoting not Marx and Lenin, but quoting Jefferson and Washington and Jackson, marching in the streets of Beijing. But June 4th was the day when the Communist Party leadership, led by Deng Xiaoping, rolled in the tanks and the troops, and innocent students, demonstrators, were gunned down in the streets of China's central square, Tiananmen Square, and some of them were run over by tanks. And after that, Deng Xiaoping decided that it was too dangerous. Western ideas, especially the ideas of America, where we have respect for liberty and order, were dangerous. And so in reaction to that, he put in place what he called a patriotic education program to indoctrinate all kids in China from kindergarten through college in the glories of China's history. And so what kids start getting in kindergarten is the idea that China in every aspect is superior to the rest of the world, that by virtue of this superior culture, China is owed universal deference, that the rest of the world should simply bow in awe at China's superiority. They also argue that the Chinese people, and this is something that particularly is upsetting, I think, for Americans who believe in the fundamental equality of all human beings because we possess immortal souls. They argue in China, the leadership argues in China, tells its own people that you are a superior race, that we are a racially superior people. It concludes from its long centuries of dominance over countries like Korea and Vietnam, which were part of China for many centuries, and its dominance over Tibet and Manchuria and Mongolia, that it has a natural right to once again rule the region. They teach the kids that they were humiliated by the British in the First and Second Opium War, but that their main enemy is the United States of America. And the kids are taught that they must seek revenge against the United States, in particular against the West in general, for the humiliation that China endured, which was all the more galling because China had a natural right to rule, you see, and China had ruled its region for centuries. They teach their children that China will one day soon be the dominant power in the world, and that the only thing that stands in the way of that dominance is the United States of America. And literally, you know, it's a hard thing to say, but Chinese children are actually taught to hate the reigning hegemon, which is to say the United States, for standing in the way of achieving the China dream of world dominance. China dismisses the current world order as unjust. It thinks itself not only justified, but actually clever and sophisticated for deceiving its way to dominance. Beijing's rulers believe they have a natural right to dominance, and so anything they do, whatever deception they practice, whatever strategic, deception they undertake is justified because they have a right to rule, and anything that stands in their way is necessarily unjust. So all of these things put together, are sort of topped off by the idea that the Chinese leadership has convinced themselves that the people of the world will actually greet China's leadership with joy. That is to say that once China becomes the dominant power in the world, the rest of the people will rejoice because China will bring order and stability everywhere. That's a level of self-deception, I think, that almost beggars the imagination, that the Chinese Communist Party could think that the rest of the world would welcome its rule, when in fact, as you and I know, it wouldn't.
Well, at the moment I really got scared, you quoted Mao when he was in Moscow and the subject of nuclear war came up, and he said, what does it matter if we lose 300 million people? Our mothers will make that up in a year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the attitude, as you also say, according to the Chinese paradigm, people are property. And if people are property, then their potential death in a nuclear war is not something that the reigning elite care a great deal about. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. There is a callous disregard for human life in China today, held by the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party. And one way to illustrate that, of course, is to quote Mao, who when he said that in Moscow in 1958, saying, "So what if we lose 300 million people in a nuclear war? Our women, our mothers will make it up quickly." That shocked Khrushchev, as Khrushchev was not a man who was easily shocked.
And that's when he pulled out his nuclear technology.
That's when he decided that he was going to renege on his promise to give Mao a bomb, nuclear weapon, because he thought Mao was obviously insane. So Mao was also the fellow who set up, who talked about setting up an Earth Control Committee. And he said, when we become powerful enough, we will set up an Earth Control Committee to dominate the world, because China has a natural right to that. But I think another illustration, more recent illustration of the callous disregard for human life, is the fact that 400 million unborn Chinese have been sacrificed to the one-child policy. Many, of course, sacrificed brutally in that their mothers were arrested for the crime of being pregnant. The mothers were forcibly aborted and then forcibly sterilized. So any country that, will forcibly abort 400 million of its own unborn citizens will obviously stop at nothing to carry out its plans. And its plans involve, China becoming the dominant economic and military partner in the world. China's economy is already arguably larger than that of the United States in terms of purchasing power parity. I don't think in absolute terms it has yet reached that mark, and I hope that with the 4% growth that we are now going to see in the United States, that we can delay the day, perhaps for a long time, that China actually becomes economically more powerful than us, because we face a very, very dangerous future if China's economy continues to grow and ours does not.
I want to talk to you later about what we, the American consumer, can do about that. But I want to focus on these events that are happening in the South Pacific, where China is just moving in and claiming territory, and then saying that once we've claimed it, we will defend it militarily. How widespread has that been thus far?
Well, it's an amazing territorial claim. China began 20 years ago, this is a relatively new claim, claiming that the entire South China Sea, which is an area about the size of the Caribbean. This is not a small inland sea. This is a major chunk of the world's oceans. The entire South China Sea belonged to it. Ignoring and disputing the claims of the Philippines and Taiwan and Malaysia and Brunei and Indonesia to own parts of the South China Sea. And this is an astonishing claim. I mean, imagine if we would never do this, of course, but imagine if the United States suddenly said that the entire Caribbean belonged to it, that it was American sovereign territory, and that anyone who questioned American sovereignty in the Caribbean would be met with force, because we will defend American territory with military might if need be. Of course, as I say, we would never make that claim, but China has. And China has also, after making this claim, which is disputed by six other countries, has now said they will defend it by force. And they are actually building, in the midst of open ocean, they are taking sandbars, pouring hundreds of thousands of tons of concrete on top of them, and building artificial islands, which they then militarize with surface-to-air missiles and jet fighter squadrons and naval bases. Again, that's an astonishing thing. In normal times, that would be considered an act of war. When these smaller countries, the Philippines and Vietnam and the other countries that are around the South China Sea, protest this aggression, the Chinese foreign minister has said to them, you have to understand, China's a big country, you are small countries, and that's just a fact. Well, it may be a fact of geography, but as a fact of life in the civilized world that we created since the Treaty of Westphalia back 400 years ago, we recognize the rights of states. We recognize the importance of clearly described borders, and we don't invade other countries, understanding that that's an act of war. What China has done is essentially invade the coastal regions of all of these countries and claim the territory for themselves. It's much like Nazi Germany, marching into the, militarizing the Rhineland, or taking, I think, a better example is demanding the Sudetenland from Czechoslovakia in the months leading up to the Second World War. It's a very aggressive and destabilizing territorial claim that has led China's neighbors, Vietnam, for example, to begin building a submarine force and may lead to open conflict in the days to come. It has led Indonesia to start building a major naval base on the South China Sea to confront China over its territorial claims. This is something that I dare say a normal country would not undertake to do. A normal country would seek to resolve its disputes with its neighbors over territory by sitting down and negotiating a peaceful resolution. In fact, when our president was recently in Asia, I was very proud of him because he told the assembled nations of the ASEAN, of the Asian Southeast Asian Alliance, that the United States would be happy to mediate the territorial dispute between China and the other countries of ASEAN. Of course, China was deeply offended by the suggestion, saying it would prefer to solve the problem bilaterally. But the only reason it says that is because it considers itself to be a big country, and the other countries are small countries. And the bully of Asia, again, coming back to the title of the book, the bully of Asia thinks that it can simply bully these smaller countries into accepting its view of the matter because they're so small they will not dare stand up to the bully.
Talking with Stephen Mosier, president of the Population Research Institute, about his new book from Rangery, Bully of Asia. It's a must read. I'm sorry that I have to say that, but it really is. You will find out from this book what the biggest threat to our country, perhaps the world, is in the next 20 years and following. We'll be back with Steve Mosier just after this short break. Thank you. I am back with Stephen Mosier, president of the Population Research Institute. We're talking about his newest book, Bully of Asia. And we were talking about that he was very glad that President Trump, in his recent trip to Asia, offered to mediate the dispute between the nations in Southeast Asia and the encroachment of China in claiming territory of their own and building of military bases. Steve, what are we doing militarily to deal with this?
Well, I think the first thing that that we're doing, and the most important thing that we're doing, is reassuring our allies in Asia that America is going to remain firmly committed to the alliance we have with South Korea, the alliance we have with Japan, the alliance that we have with the Philippines, and with Australia. One of the most important things that happened during President Trump's trip was he met with what's called the Quadrilateral Group, which includes India and Australia, Japan, and the United States. Those countries which sit to the east and to the south of China and have the largest economies and the most robust militaries have all joined together, I think, I don't want to use the word contain, but to check China's ambitions by letting China know that those four countries, all of which are democracies, all of which have substantial economies, are united in their desire to preserve the current world order in East Asia and not allow China to run roughshod over its smaller neighbors. I think India's incorporation into America's defensive strategy is a brilliant move. India is obviously the world's largest democracy. It is a country whose economic future is very bright. In fact, in some ways brighter than that of China, because China has eliminated 400 million of its future citizens. India has a younger and more dynamic population now than China because it doesn't have a one-child policy. So its future prospects for economic growth are substantial. And it's looking to us to arm its navy with the weapons that it will need to confront China in the Indian Ocean and in the South China Sea. One of the things that the president came back from Asia talking about was the fact that we will be selling arms to Japan and to South Korea. But I think there will also be an effort to integrate the Indian Navy, and of course we already have the Australian Navy using American equipment, into joint exercises so we can demonstrate and practice interoperability. Even if China's economy becomes larger than that of the United States, we will still have Japan, third largest economy, Australia, about number 12, and India, which I think is 5 or 6 now, join together, create an economic, unit, the size of which China cannot match. I actually have a son now in Okinawa. His helicopter squadron was recently forward deployed to Okinawa. I have 4 sons in the military right now. So we're pretty well committed to the defense of the United States of America.
Yes.
As a family. But we have a base now in northern Australia near Darwin, where we rotate in several battalions of Marines each year to train with the Australian Army. We are, as I say, getting closer to India. We're going to be putting in place in South Korea THAAD missile defense systems, and we're going to be working even closer with Japan to create a missile defense system. It is an incredible thing that these North Korean missiles, which are built out of Chinese components, are being sent over the Japanese home islands. It's an incredibly aggressive act, and I think the president was also right in saying, let's shoot them down. If someone were firing missiles over any territory owned by the United States, I think we would do our best to take them out of the sky, simply as a wake-up call to the aggressor that sort of behavior will not be tolerated. So wherever I look in the Pacific, in terms of our alliance with the East Asian countries, in terms of our alliance with the Southeast Asian countries and Australia, in terms of our new and growing relationship with India, I think I see progress in the right direction. We are now calling the whole theater. We're no longer calling it the Asian Pacific. We're calling it the Indo-Pacific, incorporating India into the defensive perimeter of the United States. I think is one way to check China's ambitions.
I think it would be helpful, Steve, if you explain to our listeners the way in which you wove the contrast between Confucianism and legalism and their relationship in the establishment of Chinese culture and its authoritarian political system. That was very helpful as I went through your book. Could you start with what you mean by legalism?
Well, that doesn't mean in Chinese anything like what it would suggest to the English listener. Legalism or fajia was a school of ancient Chinese statecraft that focused on concentrating power in the hands of the sovereign. Initially, China was divided into China's feudal period began 2,700 years ago and lasted for about 500 years. And China was initially divided into hundreds of small feudal territories ruled by dukes and princes and later on by kings. And each of those territories was at war with the others. China's feudal period was a period of total chaos and confusion. It was known as a war of all against all for 500 years. And it ended in 220 BC with the consolidation of all of these feudal territories into one China by a gentleman who's called the first emperor of the Qin Dynasty. The first dynasty was the Qin Dynasty, which is where we get the word China from. The Romans referred to the Qin Dynasty as China for the first time because they heard rumors of this great country to the east that came along the Silk Road. And what the legalists believed, what these practitioners of legalism believed, was that just as there can only be one sun in the sky, so there can only be one emperor. And they sought to collect all power into the hands of the man who was to become the emperor. All power in the sense of political commissars who were in the ranks of the military to keep the generals loyal to the emperor. All cultural power in the sense of the books of competing philosophies of Confucius, the books of Confucius, the books of Mencius, the books of the other philosophers, the Maoists and the others, were all burned when the legalists came to power because they did not want to allow competing ideologies to their own to even survive. And Confucian scholars and the followers of Mencius and other people who objected were killed in large numbers. Anybody who had a forbidden book 2,200 years ago in China under the Qin Dynasty would be taken out and executed and the book burned. The most famous act of most famous atrocity committed by the first emperor of the Qin Dynasty, the emperor who unified China, was he took 260 of the leading Confucian scholars from across China, men of great learning and wisdom, and buried them up to their necks in sand, and then ran over their heads with chariot wheels to brutally kill them all.
This was after they castrated them, cut off their ears, and other torture.
This was after they had been tortured for some time. This was the coup de grace, as it were, the final insult, smashing their heads with chariot wheels to try to, as a metaphor for the uselessness of the learning that those heads contained in the view of the legalists.
Wasn't Confucianism actually rewritten to fit legalism?
Well, the first dynasty, the Qin Dynasty, was a brutal, no-holds-barred, barbaric legalism that focused on punishment and instill fear into the hearts of every living Chinese in order for them to become obedient to the first emperor of the Qing dynasty. That, of course, led to a massive revolt a few years later when the first emperor of the Qing dynasty and his son was killed, and the Han dynasty, the next dynasty, was put in place. This is a dynasty that lasted 400 years. And the leaders of the Han dynasty took a slightly more sophisticated view of their rule. They wanted to convince the people to follow them because of Confucian precepts, that everyone owed obedience to the emperor, that older brothers should be dominant over younger sons, that students should obey teachers. It was a civil code. It was a code of civil behavior to govern relations between the sexes, relations that wives were to be obedient, that younger brothers were to obey their older brothers, that sons were to obey fathers, and that everyone was to obey the emperor. So they used Confucianism as a cover to legalism. And so the Han Dynasty emperors dressed up the brutal iron scaffolding of legalism, this totalitarianism, in this beautiful silken costume of Confucianism, so that the people would kowtow of their own accord rather than having to always be forced into bowing to the emperor. And it's worked for 2,000 years. Even today, we find a lot of China scholars who are so mesmerized by the silken costume of Confucianism that they fail to see that underneath is still the iron scaffolding of legalism. I spoke several years ago at Central Intelligence Agency before, I think, a group consisting of every China watcher employed by the CIA. And I told them about the bully of Asia. I told them that China was reverting to type and that China was intent upon becoming the dominant power in the world. And I remember one of the analysts came up to me afterwards and said, you've really misunderstood China, because China is basically a Confucian country. It disesteems violence. It rarely goes to war. It manages its population by in a benevolent way. The dictator, Xi Jinping, is a benevolent dictator. He's like the emperor, and the people of China are his children. So he was so distracted by the silken costume of Confucianism that he failed to see that the root of China's political power 2,000 years ago and today is exactly the same. It is based on raw force. But they don't use raw force unless they have to. But the threat of raw force is always there.
The threat of raw force is always there. I mean, after reading this book, Steve, I feel like anything I see coming out of China in the way of governmental statements, political statements, simply can't be trusted. Is that fair?
Well, I hesitate to paint with that broader brush if I didn't know China so well. It is a fact that in China, you know, we use the phrase win-win. Here's a good example. We use the phrase win-win in negotiations, and we go to the negotiating table and we try to craft an agreement where both parties win, so that when we do trade relations with China, we want to win, of course, but we want China to win as well, so we both benefit from a mutually fair and balanced trade. Well, win-win has a very different meaning in China. In fact, it's a national joke at America's expense, because what win-win means in China is, to the Chinese, is this, that when China sits down at the negotiating table, it says, we're a poor developing country, you need to give us very favorable trade terms.
Are you kidding?
And so we give them very favorable trade terms, and then that's the first win. And the second win is, before the ink is dry on the agreement, China is cheating on it. So it wins in the original negotiations, and then it wins a second time by cheating. So that when Americans say win-win, the Chinese negotiators smile and nod and are laughing inwardly at us because for them it really means that China wins twice.
Does President Trump get this?
Americans. I think President Trump is a bottom line guy. And when he sees the trade imbalance that we're running with China, closing in on, what, $400 billion a year, he says, this will not stand. And he came back from China with about $300 billion in new trade agreements. Now, I believe that the best that his predecessor, President Obama, was able to do was about $100 million in trade agreements. So it's Trump 3, Obama 1 in terms of the raw trade deals. But he also came back with other trade agreements with Japan, South Korea, and other countries. So the total number of trade agreements is probably close to $400 billion. That's not bad for 12 days' work, I must tell you. So, and I think he will do what Obama didn't do. He will actually track these agreements and make sure that China keeps its promises in the year or two to come. So I think just by being in Asia, just by being presidential, just by not bowing and scraping, just by not rolling over the way that his predecessor was rolled so many times by the Chinese that I think they came to see him as weak and easily manipulated. The Chinese respect power, and they see in President Trump a strong leader. And I think they have respect for that. And you know, he was criticized, the president was, for referring to Xi Jinping as the king of China.
But he is.
Diplomats. Some of our diplomats thought that wasn't a very diplomatic phrase. But in fact, Xi Jinping is more than the king of China. He is the new Red Emperor. And I think by identifying him as the king of China, Trump did something very, very important. You know, in the art of the deal, one of the things you have to do is you have to identify who the principal is on the other side. You don't want to be negotiating with a second or third tier person. Well, it's very clear that Xi Jinping is number one in China in the way that nobody has been number one since Mao Zedong. By saying that he's the king of China, Trump was basically saying to Xi Jinping, I know you're in charge. I know that you're the decision maker. And I expect you to reach agreements with me to balance our trade relationship and to deal with North Korea. I think he was putting, in a very interesting way, he was putting Xi Jinping on notice that he was coming for him.
How does the Chinese military compare with our own?
Well, that's an interesting question. The Chinese military is built in the same way that the military of the Soviet Union was constructed. And that is to say, it is built with a confrontation with the United States of America in mind. So China's working on weapon systems that it believes will be useful in order to defeat us. So we are the, in Chinese war games, for example, we are the enemy of choice. So all of the Chinese military exercises, the new weapon systems, the ones that are being designed, are designed to defeat the United States and its allies. Of course, our allies are armed with U.S. weapons. So what will work well against us will also work well against the Japanese and the South Koreans and so forth. So we have to understand that the Chinese military doctrine is a very odd thing, because it is not a defensive strategy. It is very much an offensive strategy. China declares that it has the right, when it sees a threat, and maybe the threat comes from Vietnam, maybe it comes from Japan, maybe it comes from the United States. When China sees a threat, it reserves under its military doctrine the right to launch a preemptive strike. And it calls that a defensive offense. Okay? So there's a little bit of deception in the language. But the important thing to know is that they reserve the right to launch a first strike against anything perceived as a threat, and yet they call it a defensive measure. Finally, I think people should understand that the head of the Chinese military 20 years ago said that war between the United States and China is inevitable. Now, I don't think that any American admiral or any American general who declared that war between the United States and China was inevitable would long be in office. I think his retirement would be forthcoming very, very quickly. But the Chinese military is given in the pages of the People's Liberation Daily, in the pages of the various strategic journals published by the military, it's very clear that there is a lot of very aggressive language used by China's military leaders, and indeed by political leaders as well. I would like to tell our listeners that the Central Intelligence Agency is doing a good job of tracking what is happening in China. But in my view, we have far too few people watching China. We had about 1,000 people watching the Soviet Union at its height. We only have a couple hundred watching China now. We need to increase that number dramatically. And the other thing that is worrisome is that a lot of the material that the analysts are seeing, they're seeing in translation. When I was at the CIA speaking, I asked how many of the China analysts could actually read, write, and speak Chinese, and only one hand went up. Only one hand went up out of over 100 people. And they were all reading Chinese documents in translation. And the Open Source Center, where the Open Source Center is the agency that does the translations, deliberately does not translate a lot of the anti-American rhetoric. Why? Because they say it's a duplicate, it's repetitious, it's boilerplate. But it matters, Deal, if the Chinese press is repeatedly calling America the enemy and repeatedly talking about Chinese hegemony and the need to defeat American hegemony and so forth. It's important to translate all of that because words matter, and it may be repetitious, but it's drummed into the Chinese people that they have a natural right to rule Asia and larger parts of the world. And it is also being drummed into them that America is the primary force standing in the way of China's manifest destiny to rule the world. So it's important that our analysts and our politicians understand this. And right now, a lot of that material is not being translated.
I hope that our listeners are going to get a copy of Bully of Asia by Stephen Mosier, subtitled Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. It's really opened my eyes very, very widely. Steve, we look back at 1972, Nixon and China. I think perhaps a lot of people of my generation think of that as kind of a signpost that China was not going to be a threat in our future. It hasn't worked out that way, has it?
Well, it hasn't. And I think that Richard Nixon, who was a very astute geopolitical strategist, recognized that there was a danger in playing the China card. He reportedly said to Henry Kissinger, shortly after the opening, quote, "I hope I haven't created a monster."
Really?
Well, yes. In the late 1970s and 1980s, it seemed that he had not. It seemed during those years there was a reform movement in China. There were Chinese leaders like Zhao Ziyang who were interested in gradually opening up the political system and if not democratizing, at least coming to respect human rights and enforcing the rule of law in China. But all that ended at Tiananmen Square, and the hopes for a democratic China died, I think, that day on Tiananmen Square, and they've been regularly murdered since. I mean, every leader since Deng Xiaoping has shown his claws when confronted. Hu Jintao had peaceful demonstrators in Tibet shot. Jiang Zemin had the peaceful followers of the Buddhist sect, Falun Gong, arrested by the hundreds of thousands and executed in their tens of thousands. And of course, Xi Jinping is now carrying out what other China watchers, not just me, but other China watchers, call a reign of terror in China, arresting human rights attorneys, arresting political dissidents of all stripes, arresting Catholic priests and bishops for unauthorized religious activity, carrying out campaigns in Tibet and among the Uyghur population in the West to stamp out any idea of local sovereignty. So China is going in the wrong direction. It's been going in the wrong direction for a long time.
And when I was over there 2 years ago, as you know, because you held my hand before and after that visit, I couldn't find anybody under the age of 30 who had ever heard of the Tiananmen Square incident.
Right.
They didn't even know about
T's. It. There are three T's that you don't mention in China: Tibet, Taiwan, and Tiananmen. And you don't mention Tibet because the Tibetans want to be independent. You don't mention Taiwan because on Taiwan you've got 24 million Chinese who've done what no Chinese people have ever done in 5,000 years of Chinese history. They have a fully functioning democracy, peaceful transition of power after four elections between two political parties. They are an example. They're a beacon of freedom to the rest of China. And, of course, you don't talk about that on the mainland. And, of course, you don't talk about Tiananmen, that bloody massacre carried out by the Chinese Communist Party to stay in power.
Whatever happened to that young man who stood in front of the tank?
We actually don't know. I heard at the time, and at the time, Deal, I went around the world interviewing dissidents who had escaped from China, and we asked them what had happened to him. We understand that he was arrested right after the incident, as you would expect, and was never heard from again. So I kind of suspect he was immediately executed.
Wow. Stephen Mosier, your book is wonderful. It reads beautifully. It's presented beautifully by Regnery. It's a delight to have in my hand and to read. It's called Bully of Asia. I would strongly recommend our listeners get it, and not only get it, but give it away for Christmas. And I want to thank you for being my guest again on Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dale.
To all of you listening, we'll be back with another great guest right after this break.